Hello and welcome to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing nonprofits, social justice, and activism. My name is Ethan Clow, your host, and you're listening on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And welcome to our third episode of The Sector. Can you believe it? We've gotten to 3 weeks. Fantastic news, if I don't say so myself. So if you're listening live on CITR, good morning. It's a beautiful day. And if you're not listening live, if you're listening via podcast, then welcome to the show, wherever you might be. And a reminder to all our listeners to visit us online at our website, sectorpodcast.wordpress.com, as well as visiting our Facebook page, as well as Twitter, where we are at Sector Podcast. You can take part in all the discussions online, as well as comment on our show notes and download the podcast. If you visit our website, you'll notice that it's very nice looking. We have a brand new logo designed by a good friend of mine, Mr. Gary Leons, and I want to give a big shout out to Gary for all his help. He's a fantastic graphic designer who's helped us out in the past with many projects, designed a lot of the posters that we used to use for CFI back when I worked with them. So you can tell, very talented artist, so please do go check it out, at the very least to see the amazing artwork. It is fantastic, if I don't say so myself. Well, we have a great show today. We're going to be talking about the big question of the week from last week, which was on overhead, and we'll get to your feedback on that in a moment. We're also going to talk a little bit about the Portland Hotel Society. If you've been following the news lately, you may have heard of them and some of the financial issues that have been going on there. So we'll take a look at that and, again, see how that relates to the question of overhead and how that impacts donor relations and the public perception of a nonprofit. We also have an interview with Vanessa Chase, who is a nonprofit consultant and author of the Storytelling Nonprofit blog. So we'll get her perspective on things like overhead, as well as what makes a successful nonprofit, and how do you incorporate storytelling into your mission. Very fascinating stuff, so stay tuned for that. Let's take a quick commercial break here on The Sector, and we'll be back with more after this.
Hello, this is Rebecca Watson, creator of Skeptic and co-host of the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
To make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the UBC and Kitsilano area at
The Australian Boot Company, Banyan Books and Sound, The Bike Kitchen, The Cove, Dentry's Pub, Displace Hashery, Limelight Video, The Eatery, Fresh's Best Salsa, Gargoyle's Bar and Grill, Lotusland Tattoo, Nuba Kitsilano, Prussian Music, Rufus's Guitar Shop, and the UBC Bookstore.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus, or go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure.
And we're back here on The Sector. On our last show, I posed the big question of the week. What do you think about overhead? The sometimes vague term for the administrative or fundraising costs associated with nonprofits. I asked you how you felt about this. How much of your donor dollar are you comfortable with being spent on things like staff salary, office rent, or fundraising expenses, etc., etc.? And looking at the responses that I got, it's clear that most of you are not comfortable with that. Indeed, most people said that they prefer to give to organizations that put the majority of their donations to the cause and not administrative or fundraising costs. Now, this, of course, is a perfectly reasonable way to think. We want to feel like the donation that we're giving is actually going to the cause. But in the interest of offering a different perspective, I'm going to suggest that overhead may not be as bad as you think. Let's talk about it in three different ways: administrative, fundraising, and the cause. The cause in quotation marks, capital letters, if you will. Now, with administrative, we don't like the idea of donating to pay somebody's salary. But where else is that money going to come from? In the last few years, we've seen funding sources like the government and grants dry up significantly, which means with less funding, nonprofits need leadership that can guide them through these tough times. How do you retain good leaders if you don't pay them well? And how can you pay them well if you don't dedicate some amount of your income to paying them? And it doesn't even have to be the CEO or executive director. Frontline staff need to be paid a living wage. Otherwise, you lose these people to the private sector where, I mean, let's face it, they get paid significantly better in terms of salary and benefits. In terms of fundraising, it's a similar problem to the administrative costs. We don't invest in fundraising. We'll never be able to improve, and thus we won't get more donations and won't be able to expand operations. Now, we often talk about money going to the cause, in quotation marks, and not overhead. But I want to propose a radical idea. Staff, fundraising, operations, all those things that we usually associate with overhead are actually part of the cause. Because without frontline staff, the fundraisers, the office space, the computers, and everything that goes into it, there is no charity. There is no operation. Now, sure, you could have an entirely volunteer-run organization. But is that going to be as effective in conquering the biggest problems our society faces? Poverty, hunger, disease, human rights abuses, environmental protection? Can these problems be solved by people who are already working 9-to-5 jobs? Now, I'm not suggesting that overhead is never a big deal or that we should just forget about it, but I do think we should consider it and perhaps be a bit skeptical of how overhead has been portrayed in media and society. Now, again, I'm not providing you with the perfect answer, and nor can I, because overhead is one of those problems that's going to persist for a long time. And this is just really an opportunity for us to voice our ideas and debate them a little bit and see where things go. That is the point of the Big Question of the Week. If you would like to add your voice to the Big Question of the Week, you can participate through Twitter. You can tweet us at SekerPodcast or tweet me at Ethan Clow. Or you can comment on our Facebook page or website, sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. We'll have a new question of the week at the end of the show, so stay tuned for that. I'm sure it'll be as controversial and enlightening as this one. Let's take a quick break.
Making a cuppa? Stop! How many cups of tea are you making? What? There's enough for 10 cups in there. Only boil the amount of water that you actually need. Very good, old boy.
That's right. The British are making less tea to conserve energy. Students can conserve energy, too.
A student's life often follows a pattern. Eat, sleep, study. During this routine, don't forget to make time for energy conservation. This will be the easiest thing you do all semester, and a little bit goes a long way. Do your laundry in cold water and hang clothes on standing dry racks or clotheslines instead of using electricity-intensive dryers. If a dryer is the only option, throw in a dry towel with wet clothes to absorb moisture and cut down on drying time.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9.
And we're back on The Sector here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Your host, Ethan Clow. So we've been talking about overhead in the Big Question of the Week here on The Sector. And related news, many of our listeners would probably have heard about the Portland Hotel Society and the troubles that have been going on with that organization. Let's take a few minutes to just talk a bit about that, as that is big news in the nonprofit world. The Portland Hotel Society is one of the nonprofits that operates in Vancouver's downtown east side. They work with InSight, Vancouver's only safe injection site, and they provide a lot of resources, funding, and support to the poorest sector of Vancouver, which of course is the downtown east side. Recently, in what's been called a damning audit, it was revealed that the PHS was spending lavishly on vacations, hotels, spas, limos for its executive staff and board members. Such spending included $300,000 in travel, $69,000 on restaurants, $12,000 on florists, and over $16,000 on taxis. Among the questionable expenses identified from the report include $678 for a limousine trip for 11 individuals from the Fairmont Pacific Rim to Grouse Mountain and then to the PHS director's house. Over $8,000 in limousine charges by an executive director in 2013. Another $8,000 on travel to the UK to look into heroin prescription programs and for other business purposes, including a hotel room cost of £478, or $887 per night, and a $65 charge for flowers. Over $5,000 on travel to Austria to teach harm reduction practices, including one night in a luxury king-sized hotel room. Over $3,000 for travel to Bristol for business purposes. Over $1,000 for a staff restaurant appreciation event. And of course, there is the much-reported media story of over $2,000 being spent at a Disney resort in Anaheim for two adults and two children. That, of course, involves some political connections that we might get into a bit later. Suffice it to say that a lot of money has been spent, and a lot of people are asking, well, why is an organization dedicated to relieving poverty spending upwards of $8,000 on things like travel and limos and restaurants? Obviously, this is an example of overhead run amok, right? Well, let's dive into this a little bit, because I think that it's a pretty interesting example of some of the things that can happen with nonprofits, especially with financial reporting, and being reported in the media, could lead to some misunderstandings. Or could it? Let's dive into this. After the reveal of these financial expenditures, the Portland Hotel Society's board, as well as executive directors and other senior management, has resigned from the organization. To look at the audit itself, here are a couple quotes. First, IAS, the organization that's running the audit, selected a sample of expenses and reviewed for reasonability, compliance with agreements, and existence of supporting documentation. PHS was unable to provide supporting receipts for many of the transactions, particularly those relating to credit card purchases. It was also found that a number of expenses were not reasonably incurred to provide programs and services. Some of the concerning expenses are included below. One of the things that I think is interesting to point out, and this is actually mentioned in the audit itself, and I'll quote you the particular paragraph. During interviews, observations from site visits, and discussion with various stakeholders, it was apparent that PHS is achieving service objectives in providing specialized services to a unique population. That may be the one saving grace in this audit, and it has been pointed out in the media and at large that this is a disaster for the Portland Hotel Society. And it is. I mean, there's no way that we can justify some of these expenses at all. Even in the light of what I said about overhead, this is extreme, obviously. But I think it is worth pointing out that the Portland Hotel Society and its mission, its cause, remain intact. And indeed, it appears that according to the audit itself, they're doing a very good job of living up to those expectations. So that's very important. Now, with the media being so critical, there has been a lot of gotcha moments, we can put it that way perhaps, with the PHS. So is there a way to defend them? Is there a way to explain away some of these financial spendings. Well, let's discuss that a little bit. Not to go into too much detail on this because we don't have a lot of time, but at the very least, let's maybe consider ways to defend them. In an article entitled "The Portland Hotel Society Should Be Defended," written by Michael Stewart in Rabble.ca, he writes, "The PHS has been fighting the right-wing BC Liberal government for years, advocating for funds for staff, repairs, and even door locks. And famously, Insight fought the Conservative government tooth and nail all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada for the right to stay open. The release of this audit and the actions taken by the BC Housing look like nothing short of an outright attack on a longtime defender of residents of the downtown east side." So obviously there are political motivations here. Now, are these political motivations enough to explain away the audit and its report? My personal view is that no, it's not. But I think it's worth pointing out that given the importance of the Portland Hotel Society and its highly politicized nature, there are certainly avenues for bias to seep into this. And I think it's also fair to point out that because of the resignation of the board of directors and its leadership, a very powerful nonprofit in the downtown east side is now facing a very dangerous situation for its future. And again, to keep in mind that this is an organization that has been highly critical of the government, both in terms of the provincial government, as well as Insight and its famous fight with the Conservative government. So to a certain extent, I think as good skeptics, we should probably be a little bit skeptical and perhaps prepared to give the Portland Hotel Society a bit of benefit of the doubt in trying to solve these problems. Clearly, though, they are real problems, though. You don't accidentally spend $8,000 on a hotel bill, right? One of the other things that should be pointed out, and this was mentioned in Michael Stewart's article as well, that for all of the issues raised in the audit and the media frenzy, the audit itself made no accusations of wrongdoing and certainly no claims of corruption. So keep that in mind while we're examining the situation. Obviously, we want to see the PHS have some strict guidelines on spending, but at the same time, we should be clear that the audit itself did not make certain claims about corruption or wrongdoing. Perhaps that is another indication that we should be a bit skeptical of some of these issues. One of the interesting aspects about this, I guess, you could juxtapose with the recent situation involving Vancouver Mayor Gregor Robertson accepting money from a condo meeting. The particulars of this were also mentioned in the article. Mayor Gregor Robertson attended a roundtable discussion by condo king Bob Rennie, where attendees were asked to give a $25,000 donation to Robertson's party. Now, clearly, there must be some financial accountability issues here as well when you have the mayor of Vancouver being invited to a prominent round table with a condo tycoon, and the end result being that attendees donated $25,000 to the mayor's political party. Nevertheless, let's keep that in mind and let's move on with today's show. Coming up next, we have an interview with Vanessa Chase of Storytelling Nonprofits.
This is my life. I wake up in the morning, I eat, I sleep, I shit.
Breakfast with the Browns.
So whatever it is, but I never shut it off for 5 minutes.
I can't wait to impress my friends with my astounding knowledge of cool.
Join your favorite Brownsters and tune in and listen to the best selection of down-tempo electropop lounge core.
Strictly Squaresville.
Remember, subtle, basic, Brown.
Breakfast with the Browns
on CITR 101.9 FM every Monday morning
from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m.
I get, the more life starts to make sense, and the less I care.
Now we're riding the rainbow, the clouds big, and we're making it like young. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville, and we're making it like you. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville.
You know, you can give 100 examples of what it isn't, but you, man, you're going to have a hell of a time saying what it is.
Hi, this is Ron McLean of Hockey / Movie Night in Canada. You're listening to CITR 101.9.
Joining us now on The Sector is Vanessa Chase. Vanessa is a nonprofit consultant and philanthropy advocate. She is the author of the Storytelling Nonprofit blog. Welcome to the show, Vanessa.
Thanks for having me today, Ethan. I'm really excited to be here.
So tell us a bit about your history as a nonprofit consultant. Where did you start out and what do you do now?
Yeah, absolutely. I got into fundraising probably about 5 years ago now. I started working at the University of British Columbia and then worked at another small social service organization in Vancouver. And it was during my time at that second organization that I really started to become interested in the process of relationship building, and specifically how nonprofits had relationships with kind of the annual level donors, so people who were donating, let's say, less than $500 a year. And for most organizations, they don't have a very good relationship with them. They're just kind of these people who donate year after year. They rely on those donations, but there's not a whole lot of substance to those relationships. And I was really interested in how organizations could do that better, how they could have better relationships with those donors. And that kind of led me into this interesting path of consulting. I started to do a lot of writing and research on the topic, and was really interested in how organizations could emotionally engage donors through storytelling, which has led me to some of my current work. And I think I started consulting about 2 years ago now, and most of my work is helping organizations build capacity and in helping them improve donor relations, kind of in those two wheelhouses.
And before we get onto the meat of the subject, on today's show, we've been discussing the question of overhead for nonprofits. What are your experiences or opinions on this potentially controversial topic?
Mm-hmm. It's definitely a controversial topic, like you say. I mean, Dan Pilato's book, Charity Case, I think was the one that started this whole conversation probably about 2 years ago now. And you know, he really makes the case that you have to spend money to make money sometimes, which I think is true. You know, I think nonprofits are in kind of an unfair position with donors a lot of times where, you know, donors don't see them as a traditional business, so they don't have the opportunity to have large marketing budgets or spend money on things like better websites or all those basic communications tools that you really need to be able to communicate well with donors and to do fundraising well, really. And so it's kind of an interesting catch-22 situation where I think donors are upset that nonprofits don't communicate with them well or don't report back to them, yet they don't want them to spend more money on tools to be able to do that. So it's an interesting predicament. I personally think that, you know, the question of overhead is a little bit irrelevant. I think fiscal responsibility is important. And I think that donors really need to take a step back and look at things like efficiency and effectiveness in programs, because ultimately that's what their donations are going towards. And if an organization is able to be as effective as possible in program delivery, maybe that's a more important thing to look at than how much money they're spending on things like communication or fundraising.
Okay, so back on the topic of storytelling, you wrote on your webpage that nonprofits talk a lot about what they've done, but not why they did it. What sort of impact does this have?
That's a great question. I think it has an impact in a couple of different ways. It's a bit of a ripple effect, really. So often organizations will tell donors, we're doing this program or we're providing this service. For instance, we can think about maybe a social service organization that has a homeless shelter and provides community meals. So they'll tell them that those are the things that they deliver, kind of the tangible deliverables, if you will, of their work. But donors really don't understand what that means. They don't know what impact that has towards the mission. And they don't really understand what that means for an individual person receiving support from that organization. And that's because they just don't have the context to really understand the work. You know, they're not like an average staff member who's there in the trenches day in, day out, seeing the work and seeing the people who are affected by it. And really seeing and having the context to understand what it means to serve meals every day or to provide shelter to people. And what impact that has over the long run. And so I think it's really important for organizations to kind of take a step back and really put themselves in the shoes of donors and think, would they understand this, what this meant if we told them this fact? And that's where I think stories can kind of come into play. They can really provide that extra aid to create context and meaning for people who may not otherwise understand what some data might mean on a website or in a newsletter that they're receiving from a charity they've given to.
And so this project of storytelling then, how did you decide that this was the direction you wanted to go in with nonprofit consulting?
Well, it kind of naturally evolved from a lot of my interest in donor relations. I think that communications is a big piece of fundraising and what organizations should be doing all the time. Yet a lot of organizations, as I just said, aren't great at communicating regularly or with information that's actually meaningful to their organizations or to their constituents, rather. And so I really wanted to take what I've learned about storytelling through direct fundraising and through some of my work and be able to take my knowledge and research that I've done and work that I've done and turn that into things that other people can learn from, tools and resources. And I have a real passion for storytelling and what it can mean for an organization. I've seen such outstanding results for organizations who do tell stories often and well. And I want to be able to empower other organizations and other fundraisers to be able to use storytelling in their work and to also see great results fundraising and also with the relationships that they're building too.
And what are some of the best methods for communicating a nonprofit's story with its supporters and donors?
I think that really depends on where your constituents live. And by that, I mean not physically where they live, but where they spend their time in communicating, in communications channels. So, you know, for instance, if they are younger demographic and they spend a lot of time online, well, then maybe email is a great way to communicate with them or a social media channel where you have a high level of engagement. But if you have an older donor demographic, you know, it's possible that sending them newsletters in the mail will be a better fit. Like with most things in fundraising, I find it's always kind of a trial and error testing for a while to figure out what really works, doing a lot of measurement to see if you're getting the results that you want, and then course correcting if not, and continuing to improve and iterate on your ideas as you go.
And organizations that don't directly interact with people, for example, like a medical charity, how would they take this philosophy of storytelling and apply it?
Great question. That's one I get quite often is, you know, we don't serve people directly, like environmental causes, for instance, or as you said, medical ones as well. People want to know, well, how can we really use storytelling? Well, I always come back to this issue of, you may not necessarily serve people immediately, but who ultimately is impacted by that work? So for instance, medical research. You may not have stories directly about the medical research itself, but in the long run, who is impacted by that? People are. You know, if your organization is doing research on diabetes, people who have diabetes currently will be impacted by that ultimately. So telling their stories is a really great opportunity. Also, the same with environmental work as well. You know, you might be doing conservation, but ultimately, what does it mean to be doing conservation work in the community or, you know, helping to do community green projects that are, you know, improving air quality and things like that? Well, that really means a better place for everyone to live. And again, it comes back to impacting and improving the lives of people who live in that community. And so I think, you know, I think you can tell stories from a broad spectrum of the people who are affected by it like that. You know, there's also opportunities to tell stories from staff members, from board members, volunteers, all those kind of internal constituent groups as well, who are super passionate about the cause, and they often don't have a voice or a face for the organization, and they can be great representatives with their stories, I think, as well.
And you also have a book coming out on the subject of storytelling. So tell us a bit about that.
I do, yeah. It's called The Storytelling Nonprofit, A Practical Guide to Inspiring Your Community. And I'm really excited about it. It's coming out in September. It's going to be a very step-by-step guide for organizations on telling stories based on a lot of the work that I've done in the last 2 years, giving people a lot of tools to go forward and tell stories that are meaningful and impactful, and ideas and resources for testing and for improving what they're currently doing with their storytelling efforts.
Interesting point on testing, because that's an area where nonprofits perhaps don't often have the best resources. So how do you experiment and test to make sure that you're improving in your ability to tell stories?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a good question. I'm personally a huge fan of making data-driven decisions. As much as I'm kind of in this emotional, visceral world of storytelling, I think data still very much applies as it would in any other kind of fundraising arena. It comes down really to the channels that you're using to tell stories. And I personally like to pick ones where it's easier to measure, or at least having a few that I can measure fairly easily. You know, email marketing is a great one. I think there's so many great programs and platforms that you can use now, like MailChimp or Constant Contact, other ones as well, where you can really easily measure things like open rates and click-through rates, unsubscribe rates, things like that, which all indicate whether people were interested enough in what you said to continue to read, or if they decided that this was not something that was at all applicable to them. The same with social media as well. I mean, Facebook Insights is getting so sophisticated with its analytics. And even just from a larger standpoint of your website platform as well, using tools like Google Analytics, you can very easily see what kinds of content people are engaging with the most. And you can begin to make better decisions about what to tell people more of, or how to change and tweak things so that people are interested in what you want to tell them about as well.
Excellent. And that all sounds kind of technical. So what sort of training, or would you recommend that nonprofits have a dedicated communication analysis person on staff, or how would you encourage nonprofits to do that sort of thing?
That's a great question. You know, while it does involve technology, I don't necessarily think it has to be super complex all the time. I think it's a really easy thing to measure and to keep track of, and it does not have to become this big make work project either. For myself, with some of the projects I do, I keep something as simple as an Excel spreadsheet, and I have a different tab for different channels that we're working on, and I just choose to measure one or two key metrics for each of those. So for instance, with one organization that I'm working with right now, we've been doing a lot of work on their email marketing program, and the only thing that we've been testing and looking at has been subject lines and the open rates based on those subject lines. And the same thing for, I think, their social media as well. We're tracking the types of content and the number of times someone likes something or they make a comment on something. So again, I think it's about picking, you know, one to three at most, I would say, key metrics on a channel that matter to you or mean something to you, and then consistently measuring those. So, you know, I think with all of these different channels and technological mediums that we have, there are hundreds of metrics that we could look at. But it doesn't really serve us well to look at all of those at once. You really just have to kind of pick one and look at it. And I think that was a cue I took from a lot of the direct mail that I used to do for organizations. You know, with that, testing direct mail is, you know, not nearly as easy as testing things online. But, you know, with direct mail, you would pick one or two things per letter to test at most. You know, for instance, the PS at the end of a letter, or the call to action, or maybe you would test what the copy on the outside of an envelope would be. you wouldn't change all of those variables at once, but you would just change them in small, small instances and then measure those per appeal.
Right. And you, you mentioned social media, and social media has sort of become a very sort of controversial topic in the nonprofit sector. Terms like slacktivism are getting tossed around about like Facebook likes and that sort of thing. So in your experience, has a strong social media presence with Facebook or Twitter, does that pay off for nonprofits, or is it really kind of varying from case to case?
That's a great question, Ethan. I think one of the things that I consistently hear a lot of my colleagues and other organizations talk about is the fact that, you know, social media is great for communication and for community building. It's not good for fundraising specifically. So it's important to make that distinction, though, because I think a lot of organizations start out on social media thinking that they can raise tons of money and do lots of crowdfunding, which isn't really the case. So I think it's healthy to kind of shift your perspective a little bit to realize that social media is kind of a means to the end, and the end being driving people to your website to ultimately make a donation when the time is right. When you have a campaign or when something is going on. So I think leading up to that, though, you know, you have to focus on creating great content, being consistent, and cultivating conversation with people. And those things do take time, and they do take effort. But I think that when your organization is dedicated to doing that consistently, it can have a good payoff in building great relationships with people.
Excellent. Well, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about consulting. So what sort of organizations come to you right now, and what do they ask you about?
I have quite a wide gamut of organizations that come my way. I have a couple healthcare clients, hospital foundations, and service providers. I also work with a couple environmental groups as well, and human service. So it's quite the gamut of causes. I would say usually they come to me because they are looking to increase capacity. So they're at a place where maybe they've been around for a while, but they're ready to kind of increase their fundraising revenue for a new program, or they're looking at starting a capital campaign, and they just really don't know where to start or where the best method is for them. And so oftentimes we'll look at what they've done in the past, and I'll make a lot of recommendations based on that, and then we'll start testing and working together on different fundraising and communications methods. I would say a good portion of those people come to me for storytelling in the beginning, and that kind of morphs into a larger conversation about fundraising usually. You know, a lot of organizations do really struggle to figure out how to tell stories well, because it is kind of a team effort. And if there's not someone in-house on your fundraising or communication staff rallying the troops, getting everyone excited about it, it can be really difficult to start to execute.
Right. And what types of challenges do you think that the nonprofits here are facing at the moment? Have you noticed trends developing where you're starting to sort of almost predict what they're going to say to you when they contact you?
To some degree. I mean, I think one of the things people always need is more money. I think that's kind of a steadfast thing in the sector. But I usually think that that comes back to the fact that organizations are having a really hard time retaining donors. So there's lots of talk right now about donor retention. I think that's a pretty hot button topic in a lot of fundraising and communication circles, talking about, you know, the fact that it's costing organizations a ton of money every year because they're losing donors, and then they have to spend more money on acquisition the following year. But instead, you know, rather than focus on doing great donor retention, they just get caught up in this huge cycle of constantly acquiring new donors and then not really knowing what to do. But it's interesting to me because I think this idea and this conversation of donor retention really comes back again to communications. You know, most donors drop off because they feel like they don't understand what the impact of their gift was. They weren't followed up with properly, or they don't really feel an emotional connection to the cause. And so, I mean, all of those things can be solved with better communication. That's the interesting and very, I think, surprising part to me, is that donor retention is a much easier problem to solve than I think a lot of us have thought in the past couple of years.
And you consult with Canadian and American nonprofits. So have you noticed a difference in the challenges that the nonprofits in Canada and America are facing?
I think they're pretty similar. I would say you know, the conversation in the U.S. is also largely around donor retention as it is in Canada. I think in the U.S., there's always concerns about the economy and kind of ups and downs with people's capacity to give. I think it's a little bit more turbulent than Canada at the moment. So I think that's probably a big difference. You know, the U.S. does have a much larger population, so they have higher rates of giving, more people available to make donations than Canada. But that's kind of, I guess, an unfair comparison between the two. But I guess in terms of other issues, I don't really think there are many differences. I think there's a lot of similarities.
Interesting. And what would you say is the most challenging case you've ever worked on?
That's a good question. most challenging. I think the most challenging one that I've worked on was a case where the organization really didn't know how to talk about what they were doing. It was a very sensitive subject matter. Mm-hmm. And they had a hard time internally articulating what it was they really did, and therefore they couldn't ever really tell other people what they were doing. And I found that was challenging in a good way, I think, for me, because we went through a good 2 or 3 month process of trying to figure out the language and the messaging for that particular cause and organization, which led them actually to really refining their mission and being able to have a lot more clarity around what it was they were doing. I think a lot of organizations start out with these very broad missions and broad visions, when in fact it can actually be more beneficial to kind of narrow in a little bit and be able to kind of narrowly define what you do, but talk about it in a really clear, crisp way. And that was a really interesting exercise because I think it caused a lot of shifts in organizational culture and development that the client wasn't anticipating. I certainly wasn't anticipating. Yeah. and definitely caused a lot more people to become involved in the project beyond just the fundraising and communication staff. So the board eventually became a part of it, and everyone else at the organization was also ultimately impacted by the work that we were doing.
Excellent. And so a question, kind of a broad question here, but how healthy do you think is the nonprofit sector in Canada?
That's a good question. I think it's a pretty healthy sector myself. It consistently grows. There's more and more Canadians who are giving each year, which I think is great. I think, you know, there's a wide variety of causes that are serving some of the biggest problems that Canadians are facing these days, health-related, environmental, etc. And I think that gamut is great because it certainly meets the gaps where government programs aren't hitting the mark or aren't available to do that work, and the private sector as well. And so I think beyond that, though, I think the sector itself is in good shape. I think it continues to grow and develop in a lot of really interesting ways. I'm always excited to see some of the newer organizations that are coming up, that are really being born online, and seeing some of the really innovative work that they're doing with awareness and branding and their marketing. I think that's going to continue to be a good point of challenge to organizations that have been around for 20, 30 or more years who aren't as savvy online, and the fact that they now have to compete with these organizations that are. I think that will bring a lot of interesting conversation and new marketing tactics into the sector.
So would you say that the future is bright?
I think so, yeah.
Excellent. Okay, well, we're running out of time here, but we still have time for our favorite segment of the week, that is the pitch of the week. And this is where we ask our guests to give us their best elevator pitch for a charity or cause of their choice. So, Vanessa, assuming you've cornered the billionaire in the room, what would you pitch them if you have a minute or two of their time?
Sure. I would pitch them Women Against Violence Against Women, which is a rape crisis center in Vancouver. And full disclaimer, I am on the board there, and I've been working with them for about 3 years now. Great organization in town who is very near and dear to my heart. I would probably start my pitch something like this. You know, chances are you know a woman who has been affected by sexual assault. the statistics are very high in Canada for sexual assaults. And whether or not there's been a woman in your life who's told you about it, she may be struggling to overcome what's happened to her in her past. And Women Against Violence Against Women is an organization that's really passionate about supporting and helping women through those times, whether it's happened to them recently or 20 years ago in their life. And I think it's an important group that's really doing a lot of great work in the community and really starting to open up the conversation about violence in Vancouver and what that means for women in our community. And I'm very excited to see what happens in the future for them. And a gift towards them is really a gift towards making Vancouver a safer city for all women.
And if any of our listeners would like to give to Women Against Violence Against Women, where would they go?
Their website address is wava.ca, so wava.ca.
Excellent. Well, Vanessa, thank you so much for joining us on The Sector, and we look forward to talking to you in the future and hearing more about your storytelling project.
Thank you so much for having me, Ethan. This has been really fun, and I hope that all goes well with The Sector and the continued growth of your new project.
Thank you so much.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
AMS Food Bank. Your access to money during the studies at UBC will most likely be limited, but it is a priority of the AMS Food Bank to ensure your access to food is not. The AMS Food Bank provides emergency food relief 7 days a week for all UBC students. To volunteer with the Food Bank or for inquiries about how to take advantage of the services provided, contact them at foodbank@ams.ubc.ca. For more information, find the AMS Food Bank on Facebook or feel free to visit anytime across from the Wellness Center and Sprouts.
And we're back on The Sector. Well, we're reaching the end of yet another episode. Week 3 is now done. Thank you all for listening. We really do appreciate it. I look forward to episode 4, and I hope you'll tune in for that one as well. I want to take a few minutes and just thank Vanessa Chase for the interview. If you'd like to hear more about Vanessa and her projects, check out her website at www.thestorytellingnonprofit.com. And we look forward to speaking with her in the future about storytelling and how that will impact nonprofits in the future. Now, there is the lingering question of the big question of the week. Time for a new one. Now, remember, you can participate in the big question of the week. You can email us or tweet us or visit us online at our website. Leave your comments, your questions, your considerations. We will discuss and debate the results of our big question next week on episode 4. Now, the question in case for the big question: in what cases should public health and safety trump personal liberty? Now, you might be asking yourself, well, why a question like that? Well, as I mentioned before, next week we're going to be diving into a bit of social justice, a bit of personal freedom, a bit of liberty, discussing how many rights we have, how far they extend, and ultimately, what are the limits of human rights? So I wanted to pose this question today. Public health and safety. We accept the fact that we need it, obviously, but in what cases should it trump your personal liberty? So, for example, smoking in public, wearing bike helmets, or even harm reduction drug policy. How far should public authority go in limiting our personal freedom? After all, if you don't want to wear a bike helmet, should you be forced to? Is it for your own good? And is that a decision that should be removed from you? Here's a topic that I know will strike a few chords. It does with me. What about vaccinations? They are the most successful and important health advent in our human history. And yet people choose not to get vaccinated. And we are seeing the results. Outbreaks of measles, whooping cough. And who knows what else could reappear should vaccination rates drop even further. Should public health and safety make vaccination denial illegal? We have laws against not wearing a bike helmet. Surely a law about vaccines is not going too far. Or is it? Well, let me know. I want to hear your feedback on this. So remember, you can participate in the big question of the week through many different ways. You can tweet us at Sector Podcast or tweet me at Ethan Clow on Twitter. You can comment on our Facebook page or our website at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. And I look forward to your comments and suggestions. We will dive into this issue in depth next week here on The Sector. And speaking of The Sector, we are running out of time here on episode 3. So my thanks once again to everybody who tuned in and listened or downloaded the podcast. Remember, if you want to get more information on The Sector, including our show notes, as well as links to further research, check out our webpage at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. We'll have all the information from today's episode there as well. You'll also be able to download the podcast and take it on the go. So tell your friends. And be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Well, this is Ethan Clow, your host, saying once again, thank you so much for tuning in. And we'll see you next week, Fridays at 8 a.m. here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Backwards.